We're good.
We're recording. Okay.
Well, he did a good thing asking us to just kind of introduce ourselves. Maybe we should do that as a possibility. And am I close enough?
So who are you?
Well, let's start out with Denny. I like that progression.
I'm Denny Sedlak. I'm a member of the team at the Warrior Story Field, military veteran, war veteran, combat veteran, Vietnam. I was a hospital corpsman with the Marine Battalion Landing Team. And there you have it.
And I'm Robert Bellows, and some years back, I'll just say this, I'm a sculptor, have a lot of business experience in marketing, but I love sculpture, and I didn't start sculpture because I was an artist or thought I was in any way an artist, but I started sculpture because I realized that when I expressed myself in that way, I was able to sidestep the difficult depression that I carried as a young man. And then some years back, a couple of combat veterans from Iraq came to my shop, and we worked on building a very large rooster together. And at the end of that project, they asked me, what are we going to do next? And I said, well, we're gonna do two sculptures or some kind of sculpture that tells your story. And that was the beginning of the Warrior Story Field.
Cool. My name is Thiago Leon. I'm a clinical psychotherapist. I've been part of the team since, 6 years ago? Something like that?
6 years, yeah.
Whenever we started. And it's a joy and a pleasure to be here and with you all. And I don't know if there's a lot of me talking I'm interested in, because what we have to talk about is pretty powerful. So, Bob, who are you?
Thank you. I'm Bob Lisi, and I'm also a veteran and a veteran of the Vietnam War. And I was with the 4th Infantry Division up in the Central Highlands in 68 and 69. Suicide was something that I was not prepared to deal with. And beyond my expectation, it was in my face almost as soon as I stepped foot in country, and was prevalent while I was there. And something that continues for veterans throughout the years, and it's been 50 years on since that experience.
Well,
I'll move it on.
All right. Well, my name's Dave Scherz. I've been with the project for a year or so. When I moved to Colorado a few years ago, my daughter was at a local grocery store and found a flyer about this group of vets and non-vets that were getting together and working together. And it's something that sounded very interesting to me. My brother was killed in Vietnam, and I've always wanted to have a connection with him, wonder what his life would have been like maybe if he'd come back. And it's just, I've enjoyed to be able to talk with veterans and non-veterans about the various subjects that come up, and it's been very rewarding for me.
Well, welcome everybody.
Welcome, and thank you for being here. This project, this conversation has, for me, been stimulated when I first met Robert and was out at the story field. There was a time when he started with part of his story, and in a from a suicide situation, and he mentioned expression is the could be the antidote or antithesis of depression. At the time, I was working as a counselor at the vet center, Boulder Vet Center, counseling vets from Vietnam for PTSD and that kind of thing, and I had my own issues I was working through at the same time. And I had a dream one time. I was in a situation where I felt overwhelmed, and in my dream, I woke up in a cold sweat. I had a .357 Magnum in my mouth, and I pulled the trigger. Granted, it was a dream, but I woke up in a cold sweat. So in talking with Robert, this expression thing, just for some reason, it triggered me in a positive way into curiosity and what the hell's really going on in life. And subsequently, in our conversations, we do not speak about war stories, victimization, blame, a lot of things that can happen in standard groups. But we talk more from, I'm going to suggest we talk from heart. That maybe, just maybe, we're all one heart, and each of us is a piece of the big heart. And this thing is turning out maybe to just be a medium for us to express ourselves, where we're heard, we're listened to, and the stuff we talk about, you can't go to the coffee shop, you can't talk with your families. It's an entirely different beast. And for me, the really opening factor exploring this question of Robert about expression is vastness. Vastness and awe. And in this vastness and awe, it's entirely different than the rest of the narratives that we live in or live out of in the world. And it's very challenging. And it's led to the question is, for me, what is it to rehumanize after the war experience? And I'm now 51 years out, and I'm just now, through this opportunity, being in association with these fellow men and building a phoenix and a dragon. It's interesting that Bob evolved to working mostly on the dragon and build the dragon heart, and I'm working on the phoenix, the more... that phoenix heart's entirely different, but yet it's just, if I fumble, that's a very good place to be when you speak, because you're not speaking from your canned narrative, your story narrative, and you're in, I think, exploration. And I throw it open to the, well, excuse me, one other thing. The impetus for this conversation was that it's been publicized over and over and over again that 20, 22 veterans a day across the nation kill themselves. And we have too numerous to mention programs. They're all canned. They're all out of the therapy model, the clinical model, the paradigm model, the bureaucracy model. And they've been doing these things over and over again, and there's no effect. So in my thinking, when you do something over and over again and you aren't getting the desired result, then you question what's missing. What don't I understand? And in asking that question, that's the question before us today. That what is our felt sense, our thinking on these issues, and is there something different out there? And we don't have any idea where this is going to go, what it's going to sound like. But we're all sitting in the fire here entertaining this question. So I put it out on the table. You know, who are we? What are we? And I admit I don't know what I'm doing. But I throw it open to everybody else.
Well, there's who are we, what are we, and there's also a conversation about suicide happening. And that you're bringing up things pertaining to the fact that the current models for negotiating suicide or the conversations about suicide don't, in reference to the military, the way that we're talking about in here, don't suffice.
For sure.
Why? I put that to the table.
Yeah.
Hmm. Boy, I think I can't answer why all others' ideas don't suffice, because I don't necessarily agree with that. It's what we have, and those things are important parts of dealing with suicide. But I can only go, I've never been in the military, so I haven't had that experience, but I've had the experience of life, and I've had the experience of suicides happening nearby me, and I've had the experience of really wanting to participate in that in some way myself, and being driven by that for years and years. And I'll say that in those early years, I was floundering, I think, a lot, like I see others who are dealing with that. We see suicide as a blight on society, or as something to be judged heavily, or something to dismiss as, well, that, you know, that person carrying that desire is less than somehow, or they're weak, and I disagree with that idea entirely, from within the realm of experiencing it. And what I realize is suicide is a measure of the unresolvable pain. It is not a measure of our sanity. The reason I started doing art was that I realized when I was making something with my hands, even if I was sanding a pair of pliers that had been left in the dirt, and I was sanding them and polishing them down into something once again beautiful and once again functional, I considered that as an art or an expression. And that would calm my psyche down more than a drug or a therapy session or anything. All I had to do was actively use my hands and involve my body in an expression of beauty. And in, you know, simple case of shining a pair of pliers, that is an awesome expression of beauty. And when the two veterans, Brad and Danny, both from Iraq, came into my shop, I was deeply involved in the expression of a building, the expression of an 8 foot tall rooster that weighs 4,000 pounds. And I needed to do that project. It was important for me to do that project just to stay solid. And when they came in, I immediately gave up my privacy of being in my little private art studio and invited the two of them in and gave them a creative freedom in where we did the feathers and how we did it. And what I noticed happening there was that simply heating and pounding a plowshare into a feather had a tremendous effect on these guys, and it softened them in some way. And we did that for 9 months together. And I realized, oh, expression really helps anybody. It's not just me. And I'm going to pass it off here. But as humans, every one of us need to be heard and seen, and we need to listen to and see each other. And what I'm realizing is making art is an opportunity to do that in a beautiful and consistent way, so we can, you know, I see the Storyfield project as a place where you just sow the seeds of welcome to expression.
There's plenty of places we can go from here with this, because there's a few things in what both of you have said, but there's a few things in what you said that's pretty powerful. Suicide being a measure of our pain, for instance, or the desire to commit it as a measure of one's pain. And I'd say clinically that's pretty accurate, or such is my experience as a clinician in the office, or when I'm sitting with folks with suicidal ideation, and also the stigma of not being able to talk about it or express it, or the fear of talking about it and then being placed in the hospital, and then certainly seeing that their mood changes enough and then they walk out of the hospital, and with not in no particular greater help has been achieved or greater support has been achieved. But I want to highlight the notion of expression versus repression. You talked about it in the sense of art.
Yes.
But the principle of expression versus repression seems particularly relevant here.
I found in myself that as I tried to bury my early life experiences, some of them were pretty sturdy experiences, I'll just call them that. As I buried those, I became very strong and tough, and I could handle myself. But all of a sudden, this pain would leak out in the form of some terrible comment or some action or something that I preferred that I would not show. So there's this ugliness somewhere buried in me that wanted out, and it was going to get out no matter what I did. And
what's ugliness?
Just the pain. It's the pain. Let's just describe it as the pain. And it's the pain that I could not understand. I had no way to resolve it. So I could go, oh, well, that's just that. Or, you know, it just went round and round in circles. And that attitude within me would show up in places where it wasn't something I wanted.
Bob, I saw you nodding your head to that.
Yeah, some years ago, I remember reading an article at a time when we were, I was part of a group that was focused on suicide, as there had been a member that had committed suicide, and several of the people could not fathom why he would take his life. And the article had stated basically the same thing, that most people don't want to take their life because they want to end their life. They take their life because they want to stop the pain. And I remember back to my first experience with suicide. The GI in Vietnam, who had gotten a Dear John letter from his wife and decided to end his life, and he put M14 under his chin and blew his face off. And when they brought him into my aid room, the only recognizable part of his face was the left eye. And they had told me that when they picked him up, that they had still heard breath sounds, and I was praying, I hope not, because I couldn't imagine this man living with this resultant scar in his face, and which was basically nothing. And
you're saying he was still alive?
That's what they said to me. And they brought him, and when they got him in, and I took, he had a rag on over his face covering, you know, because when I took it off, all there was just red meat. Literally, that's all I saw. And I took his, checked his vital signs to see if there was, detect any kind of, any life. And gratefully and thankfully, he was dead. And if I had found some, I don't know if I would have tried to resuscitate him. But I remember through that night, sitting there on a litter next to him, and just looking at him and wondering, what would cause a person to do that? I just was not prepared in the year of training I'd had in my preparation of going to Vietnam. Was not prepared really to deal with that kind of emotion or situation. And perhaps that was indicative of the approach to the military, you know, treating suicide, that is, to not treat it or not deal with it. Because they certainly weren't ignorant of the fact that suicide was prevalent. And this would not be the first, or I should say, this would not be the last suicide that I would have to deal with in that year. And then I look back at my own experience with going through PTSD and how the isolation and the pain of I guess aloneness in trying to understand the experience of war and all the death and the insanity and the pain that I was feeling for years and years and years, and wondering, you know, why can't I find a solution? Why can't it go away? And remembering that there were a couple of times when I thought suicide would have been an answer, the only answer. And in fact, there were years when I carried or kept a bottle of pills. I did not want to be without a way out. I had to have a way out. It frightened me to the core to not have a means for a way out. And that is just amazing to me that I can even remember that I was back in that kind of place.
This is after you came back.
This was after I came back.
Yeah. With treatment, you're going to therapy, da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it was decades. I mean, for decades, I did not know what was happening inside of me. I did not understand about what PTSD was doing. I did not understand how the war had impacted me. I mean, it would be four decades before I would even begin to start addressing, I guess, my own demons. It would be four decades before I would even hear the stories of other veterans, or even tell my story to other veterans, and starting to understand that what I was feeling and what I was experiencing wasn't unique, that it was shared by others, and it was.
Eventually, you found that out.
Eventually, yeah.
Do you think? And this is a question I want Denny for you to answer too. But do you think that if there was some kind of normative education, particularly because you were a medic, that there was some form in which they could have said something, normalized the experience that, oh yeah, and by the way, these guys might feel like they are gonna blow their heads off, or you might feel like this is gonna happen, and that should have been incepted into the training.
Yeah, absolutely. But I understand that to do that, then the military would have to, they would have to be willing to admit to the world and to the soldiers that there's something about war that's not okay, that fucks with us. And they're not about to do that because that's not good PR. When you want to recruit people, that just isn't going to work very well. I think there is a conscious decision apart of the military and the government to not address it. In fact, I recall attending a lecture by a psychologist who was involved with treating a National Guard unit in, I believe it was Wisconsin, for PTSD, and this was around 2005 or 2006, and he was under contract with the Department of Defense to treat them, and he was told specifically if he knew that the individual or the unit was scheduled to be redeployed back to Iraq or Afghanistan, he could not treat their PTSD because it would take away their fighting skill. And so he had to allow them to go back into combat knowing that they were mentally, I don't want to say deficient.
But they were held together in such a way that if you couldn't do something to take away that whole holding.
Yeah, he knew that they weren't up for going back to combat, but he couldn't say or do anything about it. And he was under direct orders from the Department of Defense to not address their psychological or mental status if they were going back to be redeployed.
Keep it status quo and send them back into the fray.
Right.
The military has it figured out in their training to take, for the most part, 18 to 24, 26 year olds. Erickson's two things at this developmental stage are role identity versus role confusion and intimacy versus isolation. In order to send us into the environment to kill, boot camp, advanced infantry training, all that, is to train us to go into an environment and do whatever it takes to attack the hill, neutralize the enemy, win the day, and come home the hero, noble sacrifice for a greater cause than ourselves. Reality of war, though, they can't train us to the reality of war, the atrocity, the loss, the terror, those kinds of things. When you get into the war, that reality becomes manifest, and all kinds of things happen as a result of that to us, especially in the sense that modern war is not war to prevent annihilation of the culture, like World War II. World War II is closest to the just war, existential war, as we've maybe experienced. Korea on, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan are non-existential wars. We are not fighting to prevent annihilation. And so the rah-rah, the camaraderie that you learn in the military, the unit, when you get over there, the reality of the war doesn't validate your experience. So there's a betrayal of the idea of the noble sacrifice. And so trust, all kinds of things go out the window. Life as you knew it, home as you knew it, love as you knew it, all these things you thought to be, all of a sudden you've had an experience that is beyond the wildest imagination. And when you're in it, it's, for me, it was pretty crazy. And I guess I was lucky in a way that I came home. I'm not a hero, but the guys that didn't come home are the heroes. And maybe they were the lucky ones because they aren't suffering for 40, 50 years trying to figure this thing out. So, yeah, Bob's onto something and pretty correct in what he's saying.
I think a lot of it comes down to control. When you're in the military, you're told what to do. I mean, in boot camp, they do take your personality away and they make you this warrior. You're told what to do. You're told to go to war. You're told to kill. You're told to do all these things, and you really don't have control over that. You go where they are, you're in these situations, and then you react to the situation. When you come home, there's no boot camp out. There should be a boot camp out so they can put these things back into you. They rebuild you so you're a person, but instead they just turn you loose. 3 days after you were in a shooting somebody, you're in a bar in Nebraska trying to relate. And so many cases you couldn't even buy a drink because you were only 20 years old. But when it comes to, so now you're back in the States, you're back in, and who is in control? Your feelings, people don't really necessarily like what you came back as. They said, don't do that, don't be violent, don't be a killer, don't do these things you've been trained to do. And so you're back here. So they say, don't do this, but we can give you drugs so that you're not yourself anymore. You're what we want. Be this way, be that way. But, you know, it's my life. It's my choice. Suicide is a choice. They can see it as control. I find I can do something about this. It's something I can do, and it's my life, and it's my choice. If I want to take my life, you know, it's up to me. And we tell them that that's bad, but is it always bad? I mean, if we tell them that it's not necessarily not bad, maybe they won't try to do it to... because they're so counter to what they're being told, they're so counter to what's there that is suicide.
Let's go there. You bring. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to say all that, but I mean, suicide is a choice that maybe it's not always a bad choice.
Let's go there. I wanna prop that with a crowbar, sort of, and make a clinical distinction here. So, okay. On one level, right, and. I'd like to suggest, and I mean, you know, Denny, you know as much about this, if not more than I do, of course, but there's such a thing as not wanting to commit suicide as having intrusive suicidal thoughts, right? That's a real thing.
Intrusive thoughts, very real.
Are very, sort of, you're walking down the street. I mean, you had something bad happen to you. I don't know. I mean, we're not talking about war again, just sort of clinical pathology, psychology level. Shit happens, and all of a sudden you see there's an intrusive thought of bashing your head against the wall or jumping into traffic. And that's never been something that's part of your life before, and it's incredibly scary for people who experience that, and they don't want to experience it, and... that's not part of their reality or a reality they're interested in. It seems to me that that domain of suicidality is very different than the domain we're talking about, although that there's a Venn diagram there and there's an overlap, but there would be a distinction.
Well, when faced with a situation where you perceive you don't have control to navigate it, or to establish yourself in a way that you're heard, you felt met, that it confronts you with reality beyond your imagination. The mind can do all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can go psychotic. It can go, it can actually check out. It can freeze and check out and just withdraw. It can go into wild fantasy. You can write novels in your head to how to have the situation work out the way you want, kind of thing. And you can imagine yourself doing things you wouldn't normally otherwise imagine yourself doing. It's how to navigate ourselves into this sea of life, this culture. And we've been programmed. I mean, there's a lot of on switches programmed into us, especially military boot camp and that kind of thing. But there's also something called the shadow. And that's the unconscious side of things. Both the culture has it and we as individuals have it. And that shadow can be, if you don't have personal experience with it and understand it, what it is and what it's doing, before you knew you did, you already had, you're in a narrative in your head. And we necessarily, there's two things we want to do when we're confronted in a way. One is to, and we aren't getting what we want, one is to strike out. The other is to flee. And striking out can be in the form of murder, kind of thing, or extreme aggression to others. Flee, if you go far enough from the flee, it becomes suicide. To put it in a little different way, PTSD can be described as intrusive thoughts of death as a result of the experiences you're in and the threat and being overwhelmed, overpowered, and you can't see yourself surviving. So you go into the behaviors of hyperarousal, and that goes, if you take hyperarousal to the situation you're in, you take it far enough, that becomes homicide. And if you go into the depression, the withdrawal, the avoidance behavior, you take that far enough, that becomes suicide. So I think this is a very real thing for humans to experience. But we don't have a school in our culture to know what this is and how to deal with it.
So in other words, it seems to be that the theme that we're touching upon is that the conversation about, I mean, there's what you just said, Bob, about the military having to recognize something about the cost of war, and also, I mean, a 20-year-old being able to go to war and then coming back and not having a drink. I mean, there.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And then, so are we saying that the surface is just sort of somebody, instead of even grabbing a shovel or a pickaxe to dig at the ground, we just, the culture of treating or looking at this in general, or even the cultural dialogue around this is comparable to just somebody took a teaspoon,
yeah,
and tried to dig a hole.
Maybe this analogy will help. Being a young person, going to church, going to Sunday school, and seeing some of the things that happen in life and on the news. So there's a day where you're there and you have a chance to ask the minister a question. And you ask a question that confronts him in a way on the dogma, if you will. And some people do go to church and they'll ask a question or make a statement, and the church will ostracize you for that. Your question, your feeling invalidates their narrative. Well, there's a cultural narrative well established in the United States about service, service to something greater than ourselves, and the nobility and the sacrifice in that. So we go to war, and the reality of the war does not validate that. So we come home, and the culture expects us to get over it and move on as if nothing happened. Well, remember I mentioned role identity versus role confusion. Well, in the military, there's no confusion about my role and identity. But when I get home, there's huge confusion about it because I'm not acceptable. Then the intimacy versus isolation. Whatever intimacy I had with my buddy, the unit, and that kind of thing, and the idea of the noble sacrifice that the reality of modern war doesn't validate, and I get home, and the only option I have is isolation because there's nobody I can talk to about this that confronts the shadow of, and this is the shadow, that it's okay for the culture to make money, power, and profit off of sending us to war, if you will. The mistake is I came home alive. in a huge regard, that's the mistake. But when you confront the culture, when you're in this, you're trying to reestablish yourself, and you confront the reality that you were sacrificial, expendable, human consumable for somebody's power and profit, and it wasn't noble sacrifice, that's just a huge betrayal of the idea of the thing. And where are the sages in our culture to talk about this or to work that out or come to grips with it? It's left us individually to do that, to sit in the fire with that. It takes immense time, immense courage, but you're questioning the narrative of how things are. And when you question it, the military and the defense industrial establishment can't hear that because you are invalidating their identity, their reason for being. And if you don't have healthy expression for that and can put the thing together in a way, you're left with tremendous social disconnection, tremendous isolation, and you go down the dark road of that. And that leads to addiction and aggressive behaviors and wanting to strike out, and you can wind up in either murdering or suiciding.
Is it accurate to make the statement that there's an inherent, and I throw this to everybody on the table, that there's an inherent paradox in mental health treatment for soldiers and there being a military to begin with? I mean, you're talking about going, that the thing that they go to defend is counter to, hold on, guys.
So you were making the comment, Dave, about there ought to be a boot camp for those on their way out. One of the problems is now in today's military structure, they're committed for a period of time of like up to 8 years or more, and they can be, you know, they can be off active duty, and they can be recalled at any time from active duty or to active duty. And so the military does not want to take away that combat skill in any way. They're not willing to do that. You know, so when they go home, they want to be able to recall them and send them back to war at any moment.
This is what I was trying, yeah. So because they didn't get recorded in the piece that we just talked about, that what I was asking was that acknowledging treatment for this means betraying a certain level of readiness or
right.
such a thing.
Right.
It's an inherent, how do you square the circle, so to speak? And, well, let's treat our troops and support the troops, but well, hold on a minute. There's a tactical edge here. We can't lose, everybody.
Right. Our troops are great, but we can't have them back here amongst us because they're broken. We can't say that because they are back here. And we want to keep them broken, if that's what it is, until they go back and they might fight some more.
If it means it keeps a better fighter.
It keeps a better fighter. It's to say that the fighter...
Yeah. So basically, until they have no more value to us, we want to keep them broken.
Well said. Mm-hmm. The modern war, non-existential war, in World War II, what the troops did was killing. But since modern war is not existential war, it's not preventing annihilation, the killing is not killing, it becomes murder. That's a moral issue that the vet faces. Saying it another way, modern war reveals the illusions of the culture USA, all of it. The good parts and the bad parts, kind of thing. And where the vet is faced with how do we reconcile that out, it's got to be done individually within ourselves. There's not a lot of group action where you can do this. I'm going somewhere with that, but I'm
okay. Boss, go ahead.
So in a way, modern war reveals the illusions and the lie, the lies of the culture. We know what's real, what's reality. We know what's true, and so how do you repatriate? That's one of the big words. They really want us to repatriate and get back into the fishbowl, the cultural fishbowl, if you will, and live to the narratives of all that. But those narratives, a lot of us realize they've been, they're a lie. And so it's very hard to really come home. You just can't get back into the lie once you know the truth. And so you need a different forum, a different thing to do. That's where the story field comes in, the idea out there, the expression, the applied craftsmanship, the community of it is we're living a different narrative and we get to come to grips with all the stuff. We try to reconcile the paradoxes that we've lived and experienced in life. And that's part of rehumanization, is how to have a relationship with the all the differences, all the polarities that you see. It's okay to kill babies in abortion. It's okay to murder in war, modern war. It's okay to sacrifice the sons and daughters of the nation for somebody's power and profit. It's not okay to question that narrative.
There's a problem there.
Yeah, the inherent problem is how do we live with the paradoxes of being kind and being human at the same time having dispensation to kill and murder?
So I love everything you're saying, Denny, and the problems we're describing here of the culture, of the military, of, you know, all the difficulties are so huge that we wind up leaving the veterans with something that's too big for them to fix and too big for all of us to fix in many ways. And so it's like when I come out into the story field every day into our project, I have to bring the focus down to the tiniest little spot of connection and realize that as a civilian, I have literally no ability to change that big picture, but I have a huge ability to change that tiny picture that exists at the story field. And I mentioned it when we started, it's like my objective is in doing this with everybody on the team is just to sow the seeds of welcome and connection and to inspire a deep personal expression. And so it's like with all of those things in small groups, we could actually give an expression to the pain that veterans feel or that many of us civilians feel just because of our whatever happened in our lives. There's many, many of us. So it's the solution is not a big solution. I think, you know, I'm aiming at a small solution where we're just delivering connection, you know, by these conversations we're having, and by exploring the expression through art. You know, when you're building the heart of the dragon, and you're having your hands run over the shape of that in the clay and starting to feel the shape of the clay, your body is releasing the tension of that pain in some way, some small way, maybe a big way. And it's not a measurable way. We, in our culture, we like to measure everything, and art is not to be measured. As soon as you measure it, you kill it. And so it's like the idea is simply to begin to use our hands and our bodies in unison with our minds and have something, have the experience of the pain, the circular nature of the pain go out into a piece of steel or into a piece of clay or into a painting or something. And, you know, I just, back in my days when I started painting, trying to express the pain that I was feeling, I had no idea how to paint. But when I took the difficulty of my story that spun around in my head and I blasted it apart, and I said, now that it's in pieces, what does my brush want to do? And I started painting, and I painted a painting that told my story. And the day that I, or the in the years that I painted that painting, I did not understand what it meant. But 30 years later, I look at it now and I go, oh, I see what it meant. But early when I painted it, it released the energy without the need to understand, but it started to open the door to understanding. That's what I want to say.
What I hear you saying in that, in a little different way, is through the art, that was the medium that allowed the tension between, I'm going to say, in the vet scenario, is my experiential authority. The gears of that don't mesh well with the narrative authority of the culture, the VA, the all those paradigms and that kind of thing. And art is the medium or a field where that tension can be held and expressed. There can be a movement or a flow. It moves from being solidified in the body, held in the mind in that narrative, and it's actually sequenced out. And when that's happening, that's a health state, as opposed to it being repressed, held inside, and not expressed.
Expression versus repression.
Expression versus repression.
So Robert, I want to push you a little bit in the notion that, I mean, you're talking about taking a small, doing something small versus something big.
Yes, I mean, it's like we could talk about the big problems in the culture forever, and we've had discussions at our project out there where we get into the big discussion how we got to fix all these things, and they're impossible to fix. You know, the culture has to come through a whole change, however it gets there, you know, but it may take years and years. It may never happen. But the issue around suicide and the pain that it carries needs to be solved in a small and local way. And so I'm understanding that as a civilian, I mean, I didn't know this when I started this. I mean, those two veterans that walked into my shop did me a a huge favor by getting me to do this, you know, getting me involved in this. But that as a civilian, you know, with the little bit that I know about the world, I can have a huge effect with a small number of people, and not by telling them how to be or how to act, not by trying to fix them, by simply saying, here's the tools to make a heart. Here's the tools to make the shape of a leg on this massive dragon. Go ahead and try it, and if we mess it up, if it just looks like shit, you know, we'll cut it off and try again. So we take away the issue that nobody hears me, nobody sees me, nobody's thinking about me. Why should I even get up in the morning? You know, I might as well be in the basement right down here. It's safe down here, and nobody's going to notice that I am slowly withering away. And there is something about a small little community that you start that has a common project, and all of a sudden there's pride around building whatever that project is. And that's connection. And when you have connection and people have seen you, it's really difficult to get lost in the revolving pain. When you have no connection, it's really almost impossible to get out of that cycle. And that's what I'm trying to say. Doing something small and powerful. Not powerful, that's a terrible word. Doing something small and heartful. Something, you know, giving, if each civilian are out there were to give one veteran, you know, 1 hour of their time in total connection, not in judgment of, amazing things could happen around this thing.
That is powerful.
Thank you.
wow. Tiago, is there in the psychology something about degrees of separation? What Robert just mentioned took the huge degrees of separation between the veteran and the narrative, cultural narrative, and brought it down into a small moment where it's not, the degree of separation is not a chasm that can't be crossed.
No, exactly. And I mean, I think part of the wisdom, and you know, again, I might overgeneralize and oversimplify some of this, but part of the conversation seems to be, or the theme seems to be, that you can't wait for, and I am not making a political statement, but you can't wait for the VA, or you can't wait for the institutions to institutionalize a solution to something like this.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And so the wisdom, the power, the heartfulness power of what you're saying is that, look, okay, if we, the story field, the art, the sculpture, obviously there's a massiveness to the art pieces themselves. And if somebody starts hearing this and have never seen what we're talking about, they obviously need to go to the website and click it and look at everything that's there. But what would it, I mean, creating connection, right? I mean, creating the best thing that people know how to do, or the most superficial and stereotypical way to sort of approach a veteran is to say thank you today.
Ouch.
Right? And versus you're talking about what, right? The conversation, how do you actually create connection and community around something like this? And does it have to be a sculpture garden the way that you envision and that we're a part of? And No, there's got to be about a different million ways to skin a cat here, right? And that's part of this issue.
Yeah. Might I suggest that there is something, and it's the concept of vastness and awe that stops the narratives. If I'm in the real experience of vastness and awe, that stops the narratives that are going on that drive my bus, and I get into something called felt sense, and from there there's the possibility of feeling, seeing, doing something, like Robert says, that the craftsmanship, the taking that piece of metal and doing it, and then if you don't
literally
like
banging on a piece of
banging metal. On a piece of metal and the community
going on a hike and looking at the
going up
space.
Where you all found the rock
right
for the quartz for the phoenix heart, mm-hmm. and then the conversation to bring that back down. There's something about felt sense. It stops the tape. It stops the narrative. And now I have a different place to think, feel, see, and express from. And it's the community, the association, that sets up the connection for that to happen.
And I think I want to highlight also the distinction of community that's being talked about here, because we're not talking about a bunch of people getting together in a talking circle.
No.
Right? It's not sort of the usual debrief of sort of everybody gets in the hangar and it's like, if you got a mental health problem, raise your hand.
Yeah. No. this community is the community of cutting a piece of steel, shaping it, putting it up there. Does it fit? Does it not fit? It's that community, that focus on the project, that stops the takes. It stops me wanting to validate my story. It stops me needing to have to validate that story to make myself right and you wrong. Gets us out of the whole three judges of I like, I don't like, I don't care. It's experiential. And your body has a chance to relate with the material. You're in relationship in a different way. It sets the stage for being in relationship with yourself and other and what you're doing. And it's not tape. It's not narrative driven.
Can I tell a story?
Of course.
The one I always tell, Bob.
Gee, why not?
I want to tell a story because a story gets us into the place of what I'm talking about is connection, and it goes like this. It's like, Bob came into the shop, and as he does every day or every time he comes in, and I asked him, well, what do you want to work on, the heart or the head, you know, of the dragon? And Bob slams his fist on the bench, you know, it's a big thud, and it goes just like that, yeah, and it's heart, you know. And I went, oh, I need to listen to this. And he began to speak to me. And I didn't want to move or change the environment in any way so that that story would, or that what he was about to say was going to come out. And he started to tell me about his first days in Vietnam. And he told me a little bit about those suicides and the things that he mentioned today. And in the process, he mentioned that he wasn't able to find his heart when he came back. He didn't feel it. He couldn't feel it. And maybe I should have Bob tell the story. But I got it for a sec. But he couldn't feel his heart. And so he started, while he was talking, I handed him some clay, and he started with his hands to build this heart. And then we talked about, well, is it a predator heart or a prey heart that goes into a dragon? And the predator heart is a powerful muscle, but it's small and compact, and it's built for speed. And a prey heart is really large, and it's built for distance, you know, and longevity. So, like, he can really... So, we decided our dragon has a prey heart, so it can outrun. You know, you wouldn't think that in a dragon, but our dragon has a prey heart in it. So, bottom line, he's building that with his hands, and something's shifting and changing, and I don't know what it is, but I feel it, and so. All I can say is, I was in tears often as we were building that heart. Just, you know, not big rolling fleshy tears, but tears nonetheless, where I could feel the pain that he was expressing with his hands into the clay. Mm-hmm. That's an awesome place to be. Where do you get that when you're sitting in a room talking to somebody across a desk? You don't get that. And the reason why that showed up was he was really working with his heart. And the other side of that is I was really working with my heart. And so I'm not the authority out there. I'm just this goofy artist that goes, you know, try it. That's what I do. But I do the art because I want to feel everything. And the gift of sharing that feeling together, where I could actually touch into some of the pain that he experienced in war, is amazing. And as civilians, I think we leave that opportunity on the table. We don't really get to... I don't know how to say it. We don't get to... There's so much wisdom there that we don't tap into. That's what I want to say. And so to get together and be with a veteran is a whole different thing than thanking a veteran for their service. You hear that? It's like, be with a veteran, be exposed, be vulnerable, get sad with them.
Curious, even.
Curious. Get curious. And then be gifted by what you get back, because it's amazing the beauty that these guys carry in them.
Bob?
The thing that really surprised me about the heart is, as I was creating it, was the focus and attention that it got from everyone, and especially people who weren't part of the project, who were just visiting, and then the places we took it, when we made presentations to the public, and once again the focus of it, that really surprised me. But I did. I had to learn how to close my heart, how to close my emotion in order to survive the year I was in Vietnam, survive it so that I could do my job. And coming back home, then not realizing the depth of how I had shut myself off, there was no on switch. And I remember... about three nights after I had come home, and I was out to dinner with my wife and some friends of hers that she had met while I was off while I was in Vietnam, and we were at this restaurant and having a conversation, or at least they were. I was kind of looking around and seeing these people just enjoying their meals. I mean, they were just doing what people do in restaurants, and I'm just sitting there looking. So, what am I doing here? I don't belong here. You know, I'm just thinking to myself, this is, I mean, 3 days ago, I was in this junk hole or in the war zone, and here I am, and, you know, don't these people, there's still a fucking war going on. And this, two of the people were Vietnam veterans. I had not met them before. It's the first time I met them, and they'd been back a year. And they're sitting across the table and looking at me, and this one guy looks at his friend, and he says, he's got that stare. And his buddy looked at him and looked at me and kind of chuckled, and he said, yeah, he's got that stare. And I didn't have a clue what they were talking about. I just knew I didn't belong where I was. And it just, in the workshop, in our project, a lot of those feelings that we were talking about kind of solidified, that these sculptures, these really aren't the important part. It's the heart stuff that we talk about that comes out in while we're putting this together, while we're building it. And so the heart takes shape. And the dragon gets its personality. And I'm standing up on the scaffolding of the phoenix, looking across at the dragon, and seeing this face that I hadn't seen before. But it's the face that I made. It's the face that I sculpted. And I'm looking at it, and it's a badass, scary fucking dragon. And I'm thinking, where did that come from? And it came from me. That's where it came from. And it was very moving, and tears in my eyes. I mean, I just felt my whole body shake and shiver, because I just acknowledged that I was the dragon. Pretty awesome. It's a pretty awesome experience. And it's all your fault, Rob.
No, it's all Denny's fault. The first thing we have to do is transfer blame.
I'll take it.
So Denny sent us an article the other day about a study that the Rand Corporation had just completed, 10 years of studying of approaches to treating veteran suicide, and they had listed six different things that they suggested we could do, but the caption of it was 10 years of study, and what they learned was we can do more to help with veteran suicide.
Oh,
and I'm really ten years of study, and that's what we've learned. And they said their quote was that there's 17 suicides per day, and it's been up as high as 23 suicides. So I don't know if that means that we're getting better at it, or there's just fewer of us killing ourselves. I don't know. But I'm just, when I think, 10 years ago, it's like, where have these people been? Veterans have been killing themselves for a long, long time, and now they're just figuring out there's more that we can do. It took the Rand Corporation, the folks that brought us, never mind, I won't go there. it's pretty astounding. Several years ago, I went to a meeting that was held down at the old Veterans Hospital, and we assumed that they were calling the community, the different community veteran organizations down there, to tell us how they could help us. And what it turned out was they were calling us down there so that they could find out what we were doing, because they didn't have a clue what was going on in the community around them. And it just was so shocking. So to me, this has been the most effective, the project that we're in, the Warrior Story field, in terms of healing and moving forward and addressing one's emotion. This has been the most healing and positive thing I've done, along with horses. So
that's all your fault too.
I know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, lovely, lovely, Bob.
So I'm going to ask a question. If we want to get at the heart of something, we want to understand it. My sense is we've got to have a pretty big, broad view of things, not a tunnel view. So we've had all these years of veteran suicide, and they can come up with no more better suggestion than we can do more. Maybe we should ask the question, why is it not okay for a veteran to commit suicide? You know, that's on the culture. That's about them. It's not about us. Are we an invalidation to them if we do it?
So, okay, to stay on topic with that, because this is where I want us to go, and minding our time also, but, and bear with me here and help me out conclude this. The betrayal that you're naming of sort of, you called it a noble sacrifice, or from the experience of sort of going there, or
the heroic myth,
right, or trying to fulfill that in any way, or that the notion that once you're sort of boots on the ground, or in any capacity, really, it doesn't matter. You're expendable, or the minute that you become a veteran, also as a soldier too, I mean, you become expendable to sort of a profiteering mechanism, since the noble war is really, I mean, we can have a side philosophical conversation about whether wars are noble or not, but they're certainly not World War II, let's just put it like that. That the cost of bearing a culture that exceeds at the sacrifice of those who are willing to die this mechanism, for this mechanism, those who are willing to die, they don't, and not that they know that they're invested in this, because they just, right?
I mean,
here, this is a room full of people from the Vietnam era, and, you know, veterans from that era, and sort of, you know, is the same awareness present today with, you know, the Enduring Freedom and the last few years worth of theater. I mean, that was not my experience when I worked in the groups at the Vest Center. I mean, it oscillates, right? But not this depth of it. And so the question is, once you do that exchange for the culture, one human being is a human being. Now you become the sole bearer of the denial of a collective culture, the denial of that the culture is somehow involved. I mean, you know, again, I'm not trying to politicize something, but the commander-in-chief once got on the aircraft carrier and said, what do you do to support the war? Go shopping.
Yeah.
Go shopping. Okay. So, they'll blow babies up, right? Because, I mean, everything gets blown up when you blow something up. And then, and they'll also die, death and limb, and, you know, there's plenty of guys that try to commit the suicide and don't complete it the way that Bob is saying, and then have all sorts of problems, God forbid, better, you know, so, and no, go shopping. And now you come back as a member of the military, and you have to bear the weight of the go shopping culture. That's part of you too. So just go out to dinner and everything is normal.
How do you normalize and validate one's experience? Because we all fundamentally just want to be met in a certain regard. We don't want to be invalidated. and unmet. It's a connection thing. What truly connects us?
Right, but what truly connects us, but there's also a very difficult time. If all you've done is gone shopping, I mean, it's Thanksgiving season, right?
That's denial. That's escapism.
People will die stomped on Black Friday.
Oh, yeah.
In the United States. Yes. This is going to happen.
Well, commercialism is the God now, isn't it?
Right.
Profit and commercialism is God, is it not?
Well, again, we're going out into that mega impossible to change scenario, and on a personal level, I say that's not where change happens. The change happens within each of us. So if I look at myself and I go, what part of war am I causing? And it's like I look at myself and I go, yeah, I'm at war inside in so many ways. And that's that ugly part of that I was talking about earlier. It's like there's so much of the dark side of me that I try to snuff out that I'm asking myself, how do I get to that darkness? And I'm asking only of myself that question. And then as we go into the sculptures, I'm asking people, what do they want to express? So I can see what their darkness is or what they're holding. And that's about it. You know, and it comes or it comes out or it doesn't. And we could change any political system and it's not gonna solve the problem for the vet.
That's right.
You know, it's like what I believe we all need, and I think is good for vets right in there, is that we need connection. We need to be heard. We need to have somebody be excited to see us. You know, we need to find a way to like put our collaborative hats on and work together on a project and share. And it's like, even when we're at polar opposites of our thought structure, you know, like Denny over here, he wants stability. And as an artist, I want adjustability. So when we're building the legs of the Phoenix, you know, he wanted this solid structure made out of 6 inches of raw steel. And I wanted a bolt-on thing to where we could adjust the posture of the Phoenix. Well, we negotiated through that, and I lost, and we built a solid foundation. And when we had to adjust the Phoenix, I learned also that, well, we could adjust it with bolts, or we could cut the spine later on and straighten it out. Both worked. In other words, you know, collaboration is this amazing process that's going on out in the in our art. And you can't collaborate on a national level. You can collaborate in a small community that you build and nurture and hold.
I love hearing you talk, Robert, because part of my experience, and I know it's part of everybody's experience too, so, you know, I feel confident slightly making a general statement like that. But it's about the nature of the curiosity. You see, because the point that I'm driving to is that once you engage, once the big picture problem engages in this exchange of sort of, okay, I can go shopping and that's a way for me to support the troops. Yeah. There is no way, and maybe this is slightly too psychoanalytic for some folks, but I do hold it to be the psychological view. There's an incredible form of denial that there's a war going on somewhere, mm-hmm. and that the way in which I expiate my guilt as a civilian to be involved in this mm-hmm. war is to go shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a human being wearing a uniform that bears the weight of that denial, and that causes them to put a gun to their head, for God's sake. And can that just be named?
Yes. I think that's
And can we depart in our communities, in our small places, in, you know, in places that find an expression to that repression, rather than just going saying thank you for your service and you know, here's a, without having any idea what the, you know, just like say hello instead of saying that from a certain point of view.
Shopping, you go shopping whether there's a war or not. So you can go shopping, there's no war. How about if you go shopping with a vet? I mean, you need the interaction. You need somebody to, while you're shopping, think about the fact that there is a veteran and what that means.
Even that just, right.
The other day I was out at the project by myself making a few hearts, and it was the 50th anniversary of my brother's death. And so I was just out there, me, and but I had him in my mind the whole time. And it's, so there's a real connection there, which is what I'm going for with this project, that's to connect with my brother who's been gone for 50 years. But if we have a way to be with a veteran and think about the fact that they're a veteran, then you can support it. Just to go shopping, it's like, you go shopping, it doesn't matter if it's a war, it's not a war, you're going to go shopping. You somehow have to connect. If you're really going to support the war, you have to connect that. I mean, I understand when people say, you know, thank you for your service, because as a non-veteran, I'm saying thank you for your service. I'm saying thank you for defending my country. And that's about it. You know, it's this thing, you know, John Wayne did that, and, you know, that was cool, so I'm going to say that. But for a veteran, it's like, well, he knows the particulars of what he did. And if what he did was kill some people, so are you thanking me for killing people? And so it's a completely different disconnect, which is where if somehow you could have the veteran and the non-veteran together so that their focus could come a little bit closer together, so that, I mean, because people do want to say thank you, but they don't know what they're thanking for. And so I struggle with that, you know, thank you. I know I shouldn't say thank you for your service, but then the other side of that is, you know, I can say, well, thank you for killing people. You know, I'm not going to say that because I'm not really thankful for that, but that's what they had to
I try to strike a conversation up. If I'm in the airport or something, it's like, where were you? And
Right, that's it.
If you, I mean, if you know a little bit of the lingo, you can have, you know, where were you, MOS? And blah, blah, blah. There's ways to, there's a way to get curious.
But that's if there's some connection between the civilian and, you know, you're saying if you know the jargon, well, you might,
that's one
if you
way,
have,
right.
if you have some connection to that.
Right.
But
if you don't, it's
very,
right.
don't. So
yes.
Then how do you do that?
Right.
Go up and say, you know, where, they wouldn't know what to say. Where were you when you were in the service? And thanks for that? No. But it's just to show an interest. Because the other side of not saying thank you for that is just ignore them completely. Well, that's not getting us anywhere.
Interesting. In a certain part, I'm hearing from the everyday narrative, it may not even be possible. Because even us sitting here, we use the language of the veteran. We've already set up a separateness.
Oh, yeah.
By naming it.
That's our culture. It's two sides.
Yeah.
I mean,
wow.
Always it's him and
the veteran or civilian.
That's potent, Danny. Thank you. Wow.
So, if I may, we have many little snippets of talks when we get together at various times out on the pad working there. And I went out just the other morning. It was Friday morning, I think it was. And Robert greeted me. We have various greetings. since we can edit this, I think it was you, somebody out there came up with Namaste, motherfucker.
I'll give you credit for that one.
No, not me.
I'm the one they edited it still.
But Andrew, I mean, Robert was there, and Robert started with, hey, Denny, I got to tell you this. I was having this conversation with myself, and so I'm going to quote him. He says, "Self, time to get out of the box of authority and into the realm of mystery, awe, and appreciation. That's where what we're talking about lives. That's where connection, that's his expression. This suicide is not something that needs to be treated. Because obviously it can't be treated, because if it was treated, everything that all the treatments they tried, if they worked, it's a conversation. It's sitting in the fire with that moment. I clearly remember watching Army of the Republic of Vietnam personally torturing their own people. And my mind body went to this place where I wanted to kill everybody around me, or I wanted to flee somewhere where there were no fucking people, mm-hmm. and I would be safe, the illusion of safety. It doesn't exist. It's a reality. And all the words people use in the everyday narrative, nobody sees the illusion, the baggage that those words are. We really don't know how to speak with and to each other in a certain regard.
Yeah, that's right.
But Robert, today, in the 6 years, in what he expressed about that small moment of working with a piece of steel and the relationship, the connection, that draws from the huge gap, the huge vastness, that brings that part of the experience down into connection, into the moment. It just naturally happens. I now can see that. You're one powerful motherfucker.
I don't know about that. I don't know, we're getting close to the end here.
We're at 90 minutes, so yeah.
One of the things that that drives me is for years in my early life, I would not feel anything. There was a suicide in my family. There was death. There were strokes. There was mental problems, and I shut off. Similar to what Bob described, I just shut things off so I couldn't feel them, and I thought I was being effective. And in order to bring myself back into the world, I had to start to feel. And what I want to say is, hanging out with this team of veterans has helped me feel more and more and more, so much so that it's rattling everything inside me. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to feel. And I wrote this poem trying to get into the mind of a veteran who comes home and can't feel, but knowing I can't go there because I haven't had their experience, but nonetheless trying to do it. So I wrote this little piece. I just want to read it here. And I don't know the answers to anything, so everything I write about is pretty much a question. What's wrong with feeling? Have we trimmed and trivialized our cultural rituals into a hollow theater inside a tiny bottle of pills? Have we squashed the mighty voice of our hearts into long forms of tiny checkboxes filled out in little gray rooms? Do we mock sadness and medicate it away, never listening to its lament? If possible, do we kill sadness, or at most give it a muffled voice screaming at the locked door of our emotional pantry? What is wrong with feeling sorrow, sadness, and grief? What is wrong with gathering together and letting the waves of these hidden feelings crash on our shore? What's wrong with feeling?
And I think
so many of us are taught not to feel. And certainly if you feel it, don't express it. And I'm saying, you know, to express it, well, let's put it this way, the pain that wraps around suicide is actually the root, the very root of our ability to express. And so if we kill the pain, we lose the expression.
But you gain the capacity to kill.
Say it again.
But you gain the capacity to kill.
Correct, but you gain the capacity to kill.
And that's what they teach us.
And that's how you dehumanize a human being?
Yeah.
Yes.
Or create, or...
But rehumanizing a human being...
Or rehumanizing one.
...is inviting them to express. And you know, I don't believe in the idea of preventing suicide. I believe in the idea of giving suicide a voice. Mm-hmm. And listening to that voice. And that's my own personal belief. I don't want to project it on anybody, but that's my feeling.
So suicide is an expression of pain?
Yes.
And if there's another way to express it?
Well, the notion of prevention and sort of the notion of preventing what you're describing pathologizes the pain as abnormal.
As abnormal. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's nothing abnormal about that level of pain, particularly in the context of what we're talking about.
No.
It's pathological to treat it as pathological.
Yes.
But if you're gonna,
that's further repression.
That's further repression. So the suicide prevention, i.e., let's further repress the symptom and go back to shopping.
Yeah.
So
the paradox is life and death. And man can't create life, or mankind cannot create life, cannot uncreate death. Therein lies the problem.
So there's a lot of places we could keep going, but, and I'm sure this is not the last time we will be doing this, but for today, any closing statements from each of you? And this can be edited out, by the way, you don't have to overthink it at all. The recording is, we could have stopped, can stop this at any time and cut it out.
I'll just say this, that for me to speak into a microphone in this kind of environment is an amazing opening. It's like I grew up as they called me the silent one. The Warrior Story Field is forcing me to have a voice. And I am beyond grateful to all the people on this team that are giving me that gift. So I am receiving as much, far more, than I'm giving in this process.
I'm enjoying your scream.
That's your closing statement, Dave.
It's just another opportunity to be with these guys. It happened to be veterans. And what we are creating, it's just a wonderful thing. The camaraderie and the working together. And at times, stories come out that I think are a release possibly to some and learning to others. It's just a great opportunity to be with y'all. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bob won.
Shall we?
This part shall be cut.
No, it won't.
All right. Thank you very much.
We blasted it out.
Yeah, we were way over the limit.
No, we got to 3:15.
No.
I meant the volume.
Oh, yeah, well. Yeah, so.